Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. And welcome to episode 11. Today we welcome Sarah Bessie, a blogger and speaker who wrote the book Jesus Feminist. And today's show is sponsored by Soul Care for Creators and Communicators. If you sense that creating and communicating is your calling, then you need to take special care of your soul. That means your whole self or your true self. Like prophets of old who brought messages from God, creators have hefty burdens and endure a lot of pain and suffering sometimes as they give up pieces of themselves in the birth process of creation. If your soul is weary, you'll find some solace and some comfort in this book. You can find Soul Care for Creators and Communicators at Amazon.com, or just link to it from the show notes of episode 11 at the SparkMyMuse.com website. When we think of Canada, where our guest Sarah Bessie is from, we think sometimes if we're south of there, we think of it as cold and foreboding. Of course, most of it is not. Most of it is just like some of the states in the United States, some of the northern states. But today on the wine segment, I'll discuss ice wine. What is it and why you might want some? So colder climate wines have a more slightly crisp and tart flavor and tend to be lower in alcohol content. The heat and humidity of warmer climates makes the grapes ripen faster and get sweeter typically, but the key is in the yeast and fermenting process about how much residual sugar you'll actually get in the end. Ice wine is a unique kind of wine. It represents a process and a product that squeezes juice from the grapes that actually have naturally frozen right on the vine. This can only be done in colder climates because warmer climates, the grapes would go beyond ripening by the time frost comes. And this type of wine, iced wine, can be done with grapes, can be done with fruit, and it just has to be naturally frozen right there before it's been picked. It has an intensely sweet and kind of an icy flavor. It's very rich and full-bodied, and the unique flavor has a much higher alcohol content. It takes special weather circumstances for good ice wine because the ripeness and the frost have to sync up in a way that makes it most optimal. And this type of product makes a dessert unto itself. It's very sweet and can be paired with very sweet desserts. It has been increasing in popularity among wine lovers, and if you haven't tried ice wine, I highly recommend it. Typically, 1 ounce is a serving size for ice wine.
Well, I'm Sarah Bessie. I'm a writer and speaker and blogger from Western Canada. I'm also primarily a stay-at-home mom to four tinies. And I think that's pretty much about it. I've written one book. It's called Jesus Feminist, and it came out just over a year ago. And then my second book is coming out later this fall. We're working on edits for that right now, actually. So that's been quite the interesting balancing act. My youngest is just 2.5 months old, and so learning how to work while having, you know, nursing and sleepless nights and all the other things back into that swing of things as well. So yeah, that's about it.
And so you got started, first of all, blogging, maybe similar to me. As my kids were napping, I started writing emails. It started as emails to like a group of 50 friends or, you know, relatives and friends. And then I'm like, oh, blogging. And I think it's a similar situation with you, right?
Yes, it is actually. I started blogging probably about 11 years ago. So that was back in the dark ages of blogging. I think I was on Zanga to start with. I don't know if you remember this, but we used to like answer questions about ourselves, like names. Like we'd be like, here's my favorite movie and here's what, you know. And so I think I spent probably the first 3 years of blogging just talking about what I did that day, you know. The movies, I liked it, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And started writing a little bit more along the way and just really began to find my stride as a writer. I'd always wanted to be a writer, and this was a way of hiring myself, I guess. And so, yeah, I got my start there and really loved it and still love blogging. I'm very loyal to blogging. I know a lot of people see it as kind of a platform building exercise or a means to an end, but I really love blogging for what it is and what it's meant for me in my life. And I'll probably always be blogging.
It's a great creative outlet on a lot of levels. You can, you know, test things out, but you can also kind of develop them in the process of like the whole journey of a concept in your mind. And I like the medium too.
Oh, no, I do. It's, you know, and again, like you said, I mean, I think I started blogging before I had children, but then it was something that I could do around the edges of my life, you know, and still do a lot of the times, to be honest, you know, during nap time, after bedtime, while, you know, in the 30 minutes while somebody's watching, you know, Phineas and Ferb, you know, whatever else is kind of happening and snatching a little bit of time here and there. And, you know, and honestly, it's kind of funny because as I've been, you know, traveling and talking to people more and more, there, one of the questions that comes up in the media for me often is people will say, you know, well, we're just seeing so many women, you know, becoming, you know, voices in the church and in publishing and on stages. And where do you think all these women are coming from? And I always kind of laugh because I'm like, the internet. We're coming from blogging. That's, you know, that was our way of getting past the gatekeepers. I mean, nobody in a million years would have ever cared what, you know, a mom from Western Canada thinks about, you know, the church and theology and life and how all those things intersect. And so all of us kind of found our way to the internet as a way to explore and find our voices and find each other and find community. And the more we wrote, the more people showed up. And it was quite funny to see the establishment kind of scratching their heads, like, where did all these ladies come from?
Yeah, they weren't in the focus groups or something for some reason.
But. Exactly. You know, and writing way more courageously and boldly than what a lot of times you find on a Christian bookstore shelf. You know, you find a lot more transparency and guts and scary topics and not as many neat, tidy bows. You know, and so it's a great community, a great area to be.
I think that's the interesting thing was that blogging led the market in many senses with topics that, you know, if it's not going to be profitable, or they haven't figured out the algorithm or the formula for making a book profitable, then sometimes it never sees the light of day. But then sometimes there's issues that come up, and all of a sudden an audience gathers and a platform gets built, and then all of a sudden what seems like new voices, but really they're not new, but they're just, you know, you can hear them finally.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's part of it too, is even the idea of these, you know, sleeper audiences, you know, like a lot of times in, you know, in Christian bookstores or, you know, in, you know, focus groups or whatever else. It's like, well, here's what we know Christian readers like to read, or what they like to hear, or the art they like to perceive or be affected by, or the things they like to listen to. And instead they found all these untapped audiences and groups of people that just, you know, had all these, you know, creativity and thoughts and things they wanted to talk about. And so it was a whole new world out there of people who wanted to wrestle with different sorts of things.
And really you, you know, one of the things I appreciated in your book, Jesus Feminist, which of course wouldn't be at all a provocative title or anything, but it's not a lightning rod title or anything, but
I know,
but was,
no, not at all,
but it was gutsy. But then when you get into it, you know, I know that people who didn't know about you, where some people were expecting feminist theology, some people were already fans and knew your blog and knew what you were going to be, essentially the style in which you were going to be writing about. But what was refreshing for me when I read it was that it was not as confrontational. It was the the vibe where the style was so much more, there was just a gentleness to it that was kind of refreshing in the environment that sometimes for good reasons can get heated. And I think I'd like to know like the process by which you came to writing it and, you know, what inspired you and then the responses after it came out.
Well, you're right. I mean, about the title, that's for sure. I don't know. I defy anybody else really to manage to tick off almost everybody with just like two words. Because there's people that find Jesus just as offensive as some people find the you know, word feminist, and let alone putting them together. So you're right. I mean, I think there were a lot of people that were really surprised by the content of the book if they weren't already familiar with my voice and how I wrestle with big issues and how I write my way through them and even what my heart is. So for me, when I was writing the book and when I was, you know, just pouring myself out into it, it was really for me less a book about, you know, like you said, like Christian feminist, you know, theory or even necessarily proof texting argument for every single, you know, reference to women in the history of the church. You know, there's a lot of people who are much smarter than me who have done all of that work. For me, right from the start, I really saw it as an invitation. I saw it as wanting to create space for the other side of once you've said yes and once you've kind of moved into understanding, you know, what I believed was God's heart for women and for men and for the church, you know, what does life look like on the other side of that? And so, I mean, for me, it was a real labor of just love, honestly. I mean, it was, I felt like I really deeply loved the people I was writing it for. I felt like I carried them really clearly in my heart as I was working. And the funny thing is that the title actually wasn't Jesus Feminist when I was working on it. I had some lovely, you know, poetic title I can't even recall right now. That's how forgettable it was. And the phrase Jesus Feminist is one that I used quite a lot in my blogging over the years previous to that, because it was just my way of saying, well, I'm a feminist because I follow Jesus. You know, it's because I follow Jesus, because I've reoriented my life around wanting to follow him, that I've, you know, landed on these, you know, beliefs and practices around how we, you know, affirm the voices and experiences of women. And of course, that was, it was a bit cheeky to start off with, but then it ended up kind of becoming, all, you know, its own thing and became the title of the book. And has spun out into so many areas of the church that I never would have ever imagined. And a lot of times just quite by word of mouth. I mean, when you write a book like Jesus Feminist, you expect to get a lot of, you know, pushback and criticism. And there has certainly been that, you know, and some of it's been very helpful to me. But then on the other side, you know, there's also a tremendous amount of people that it has reached. And I've been really surprised to see how far it went. I mean, I think when I was working on it, I thought it would be much more of a niche book than it turned out to be. But almost all of that was through word of mouth and through people, you know, passing it on to friends or talking about it or hearing about it. And that to me was pretty much the best, you know, marketing plan ever. First of all, it's way cheaper. And so, yeah, but, no, it's overall been a really good response. And I think that I've been quite humbled, you know, to hear about the ways that, it has, you know, woven its way into other people's stories and journeys. And it has been, it's still very dear to me, and I still love to talk about it and hear from people about it. And it's funny because, you know, you wrote it, or I wrote it like 3 years ago. And so it's been a while since that major creative energy was kind of poured into that message. And yet I still feel like I carry it. I still feel very close to it. Well, the funny thing was, is that because so much of Jesus Feminist was me writing also about my own story and my own, you know, it's not so much just a memoir by any stretch of the imagination, but it, you know, that does weave its way into a lot of our theology, right? I believe that a lot of our theology kind of has its roots in autobiography. And one of the funny things was that no matter where I traveled or who I heard from, you know, people would want to talk about the book, but then almost without fail, the next question they would ask me was, but why do you still go to church? It was funny to me that no matter where I went, you know, people were just as fascinated by my relationship with church and with the fact that someone like me, who's kind of, you know, post-evangelical or, you know, post-everything really in a lot of ways, you know, Gen X and, you know, whatever else has kind of wandered away from church for a significant amount of time in my life. I grew up in churches as a first generation Christian, and then ended up taking a kind of a detour and leaving church for a while, but then ended up returning and kind of reclaiming, that intentional community and the idea of being part of a local church and really putting a lot of passion and energy and love into it. And people were always just like, I can't get there yet. I don't understand. How can you possibly be doing this? And so that kind of led to some conversations and a lot of writing and work that I've been doing over the last couple of years around this idea of how we begin to kind of figure out in our faith as we grow and we evolve and we change as people, those things that we sort through almost in our faith, you know, like what needs to change? What needs to be discarded? What are some things that need to be reinvented and reimagined? As we are kind of working through and growing up throughout our lives, I think it's a process we are always going through. Not necessarily saying that truth changes, but oftentimes our understanding of truth or our way of processing it, or things that happen in our lives, whether it's circumstances or just even learning something new or experiencing something different, can often reorient us. And so then what, right? What do you do on the other side of that? And so that was kind of the kickstart, I guess, for where I started writing in the direction for the next project, was about this idea of how do you sort of make peace with a faith that's evolving? No matter where you land, right? And where I've landed on some things might be very different than where other people have landed. And the things I wrestle with might be very different than what other people have to wrestle with. But it's more about the idea of what we're doing than necessarily where we land.
Yeah. It's my background is from early childhood, very fundamentalist and very insular kind of thing. Since then I went to a Methodist seminary, but what was the interesting thing that surprised me, and I'm interested to hear what changed for you, is I was really drawn to contemplative Christian spirituality, and in Christian history, some of the contemplatives, more recent ones too, and usually tend to be in Catholic tradition. And I realized that for my context, I needed that balance, and I don't know if it was because of always being plugged in to something, always being able to be found and connected to, but not always productively, that I was drawn to things like apophatic prayer and retreat, right, and unplugging and all that stuff. And so I'm kind of wondering where you feel like you ended up.
Well, for me, so much of it is, kind of often depends on your context, but I grew up in a pocket in Canada that was very post-Christian. It was our grandparents' generation that had stopped going to church. And so for a lot of my parents' generation, it simply didn't figure into their life at all. And there was no basis for, the things that we consider givens, if you grow up in a Judeo-Christian context, just didn't really exist for us. And so when my parents, were really radically saved in kind of like that, third wave neo-charismatic movement that was kind of sweeping across the West at the time in the late 70s, it was just completely reorienting, disorienting for all of us. And so when I went to school, I don't think I ever knew another Christian, or if there was, I didn't know them, which is another part of it, right? But I grew up in these really tiny, organic communities of faith. So we went to the community center, and we did lots of the, happy clappy choruses and tambourines. And there was no denomination. There was no, oversight committee. It was just, anywhere from the people who gathered in somebody's basement, mm-hmm, to, at the leisure center on a Friday night, pastors kind of came to us often with, maybe a Bible school education, but we had like zero understanding of our place in church history or the church overall, or even that there were hymns or our denominations or any of those things. Like, it just simply didn't function, didn't happen in our life. So, I think I was 20 before I learned my first hymn. Even though I had grown up in the church. And so for me, it was very experiential. It was very, there were a lot of wonderful and good things about it. And then there were things that were not so great about it. And I ended up experiencing, as I grew up and as I kind of moved into more of the evangelical world, and then of course I moved to the States and lived there for about 8 years, and my husband was a pastor, kind of in that world as well. I felt like I kind of lost Jesus in the midst of all of this. Like everything became about churchianity as opposed to Christianity. And then at that point, we started experiencing a lot of grief in our own lives. I had fertility challenges, and I had I lost four babies. And I didn't really feel like there was a lot of room for my grief in church. And in the churches where I was a part of, it was very much, formulaic. Here's the prayer. Here's the answer. If you're not getting an answer, then it's likely your fault. Very shiny, happy Jesus people thing. And I just didn't really have it in me anymore to do that. And so like you, I felt myself, found myself kind of pulling away from maybe the churches that I had grown up in, or the tradition I had grown up in, and even the liturgy that I had grown up in, because I think every church, no matter how, anti-liturgy they may think themselves, everybody has kind of their own way that they always pray, the way that they always worship, the things they always say. And while I was kind of wandering, I kind of refer to that almost as like my wilderness season, because for me, my heart was broken. I was grieving. I didn't know what I thought about God anymore. I didn't know what I thought about the church. I didn't know what I thought about any of those things. And I was sorting through and wrestling through almost all of them. Who's Jesus? What does that even mean in my life? What does it mean to be a disciple? What is it? What is anything? What is even truth at that point? And I did feel myself really drawn towards ancient traditions at the time. And so I found myself in Anglican churches. I found myself discovering the Book of Common Prayer and, liturgical habits and things. And it really did shape a lot of my prayer and my life. It was how I remembered how to pray when I couldn't pray. Mm-hmm. But then the funny thing was, is that instead of remaining there, I found the trajectory swung me back around. And I ended up right back where I started. So now, 10 or 15 years later, I'm back in a community center in a school gym, with folding chairs and, lots of happy, clappy people and tambourines and flag wavers. And I love it. I'm a liturgical person, and I draw from a lot of different traditions. I'm a bit, ecclesiastically promiscuous. That way, and I like to pull from a lot of different places and really learn from the church as a whole. But I am back where I began and learning how to reclaim that too. And so, yeah, it's been quite an interesting thing to kind of almost have that journey of starting somewhere and then coming all the way back around full circle and almost seeing it for the first time, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those unexpected, I'm here again, but you're never the same person.
No, You encounter all those things so differently. You sort through them so differently. You process them differently, and you're a very different person within that community. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's definitely, a big journey, and you feel like a completely different person, and yet you find yourself in a similar spot. I think it's kind of God's way of laughing at us in some ways. Like, see, you can find me anywhere, mm-hmm. and in the places where you had maybe some. I don't know what the word is, even some contempt, and yet look at where I'm hiding, look at where I am, look at all the places where you can, experience and find me. And I've tried to go elsewhere. I've tried to do other things, and yet I know where I belong.
Yeah. So what do you think are the most influential books spiritually that kind of helped you in your journey?
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm a bit of a pseudo hermit bookworm. Mm-hmm. So, it's hard. Isn't it hard to answer that question? It's like when people ask you, what's your favorite book? It's like, I don't know. Like, I have like 30, depending on what mood I'm in, right? Like,
sure.
It's a bit hard. I mean, there's different ones that have mattered a lot in different seasons of my life, for sure. I know a lot of Brian McLaren's writing has meant a lot to me, and Richard Rohr, Anne Lamott and Kathleen Norris, have all of their books have meant a lot to me as well. Dallas Willard and Brennan Manning though have probably shaped my, understanding of God and, my beliefs and hopes about God more than almost anyone else, I would imagine. But I also find a lot of, myself in, you know, also fiction and poetry and a lot of other different places as well. But in terms of, you know, writing about faith and what we think and believe about God, I would probably say that those ones would be near the top, you know, of any list that I'd put together. N.T. Wright is another one that I've always really appreciated. And, you know, have really affected how I move through my life, even though it maybe seems a little bit different. But yeah, I don't know. There's quite a few. I mean, Nadia Bolz Weber, I've loved so much of her, mm-hmm. her work as well. And Rachel Held Evans and Shauna Nyquist. And mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many, like I said, just such great writing, I feel, coming out of the church. And as someone who's more of a word person, mm-hmm. You know, the writers are always seems to be where I find myself. Like, I honestly think that Barbara Brown Taylor might have saved my life a few times with her work, you know, like An Altar in the World and Leaving Church, her book Leaving Church, and Learning to Walk in the Dark is another really beautiful book from her. I mean, just on, you know, again, over and over again, I just seems like when I needed a book, the book found me.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think I completely agree. It's also sometimes that way with people in your life too. You know, I know I had a spiritual director until she moved away, which I'm still trying to get over that. But but I had a spiritual director for 3 years in the a Catholic grandma in the Ignatian tradition, and very different from me, but very like my Gandalf in the world, you know. It was just could really speak into things. And she said, it sounds maybe trite, but I've noticed it to be true that when you're ready, you know, your director will come to you, and someone that you might not even expect. It might even be I took a theology of disability course, and in that season it was a disabled person who served as my mentor in that season. And it's true, like when you're ready, that God intertwines your stories, and it is really kind of a beautiful thing. Has anybody personally been influential to you that you think was pivotal?
In terms of personally, I mean, honestly, it seems like right when you needed to encounter someone, they were there. I would say my parents have been probably one of the most influential, and continue to be the most influential for me, in terms of my understanding of God and how I move through my actual real life. You know, the practicalities of how I move through my life. You know, but we have had some amazing pastors and leaders that have come alongside of us, and friends, you know, that have also been a part of our life. But, you know, I think that probably for the last, you know, 15 or 16 years, my husband and I have really been on the journey together. And so us having each other for all of the changes and the ways that we have evolved and shifted. I mean, we are very different people than we were when we first fell in love 16 years ago. But I'm very thankful that we managed to somehow, even when we really disagreed and we're going in different directions, we still managed to stay connected. We still managed to stay, you know, to hopefully grow around to each other eventually. So that's been definitely a big part of it. But I mean, honestly, I have a really close knit and good couple of good groups of very good girlfriends, and I rely very heavily on them. You know, in terms of, they have often ruined my life in very good and holy ways. It'd be so much easier to stay comfortable and, you know, stay in kind of your little box. But instead, they have stretched me and challenged me and changed me. One would be Edelette McVicker, who also runs She Loves Magazine. She has just, you know, brought so much richness and so many good relationships to me. Another good girlfriend of mine is Kelly Nicondeja, and she's just an amazing theologian. But a very practical one, you know, and she is, you know, just totally reoriented me in terms of my understanding of justice and the new city and what it means to live into the kingdom of God and all of those different things. I mean, liberation theology and so on and so forth, things that I never in a million years would have even ever encountered. And yet they just seem so normal to be walking alongside of with your friends. And then you begin to kind of absorb and be challenged and changed by it. And another one that I would say would be my midwives. In terms of having my children, I have found that the experience of being pregnant and experiencing loss and giving birth and now raising children has been probably one of my primary altars for meeting with God. And again, it's, you know, everybody kind of has a different story in terms of how they've encountered that or experienced those things. But for me, my midwives and what they taught me about birth and giving birth really ended up becoming the primary metaphor for a lot of how I understand living by the spirit, and a lot of how I understand even seasons of change and growth and new life coming forth in my soul. So that would definitely be another big one for me.
Yeah. Well, you brought it up briefly, but I would like to unpack just a little bit some of the things you've been doing with others and collaborating for social justice issues, and how that has come about, and kind of what you're doing in that sphere.
You know, honestly, I mean, my heart has always really been with a lot of women's issues. I mean, right from the time I was probably, I don't know, a kid, to be perfectly honest. It was, you know, I think that I remember writing when I was a bio when I was in grade six and saying that I really hated male chauvinists. So I was a delightful child. you know, my heart has always been a lot with women and with women's issues. Right from the start, I've always loved working with women. You know, so a lot of my younger days was working with, you know, high school girls and college age girls. And that led me into working with a group of people here in our area called Mercy Ministries of Canada. And so I was helping with that, which was a residential home for women who struggle with life controlling issues. And, you know, just really have loved that community of women, which is how I met Edelette, who introduced me then to, you know, more of a broader community of people who were very regular and normal, you know, moms like me, and yet really were deeply passionate about justice and deeply passionate about refusing to do nothing on our watch when we were confronted with things. And so it just seems like since then it's been a very organic path and very spirit-led path in terms of what God has brought across to me, and where my, you know, following my, even my pathos in a lot of ways. And that led me to a lot of work in Haiti, where I serve on the board of directors now for an organization that's very grassroots and resourcing local leaders there in terms of education and child trafficking and a few other things. And then now working even, you know, alongside Preemptive Love Coalition in Iraq for refugee relief and empowering women to start businesses in the face of ISIS. And I mean, it just seems like, you know, really small little things all add up to being something amazing that we're doing together. And that's how I've sort of understood it. I mean, when I was in Haiti, probably about 3 or 4 years ago, we were trying to build a school there, but there was this gigantic rockside hill in the middle of the only property we had. And you couldn't build anything on it because it was just, you know, just this gigantic rock basically sitting in the middle of the thing, but it was more like a hillside or, you know, that type of thing. And then, you know, we couldn't really figure out what to do with it. The moving equipment simply doesn't exist really, or it does exist, but it's hard to get to, and it's hard to kind of, you know, organize a build like that on ground that's a little bit unusable. And then out of nowhere, this 60-year-old Haitian man showed up with a pickaxe and a shovel and a bucket, and he laid into that mountainside for months, and just bucket by bucket, he dismantled the entire thing and leveled the ground. And I had never seen anything like it. I mean, first of all, he was 60 and he had better abs than anybody I've ever seen in my life. Like, he was a very strong man. Mm. But just seeing that happen right before my eyes, of someone actually literally moving a mountain, just stone by stone, really caught my spirit. And I felt just that, you know, that quickening you kind of get in your heart when you know that you're seeing something that's so much bigger than what you're actually seeing, even though what you're seeing is pretty amazing. Because we ended up building a school, and 400 kids go to school there now, and it employs Haitian teachers and, you know, all these other things that are just amazing and incredible that are happening there. But then even on top of that, I thought, isn't that all we're ever doing? I mean, I love to think that, you know, of course you can say to this mountain, you know, be lifted up and cast into the sea, like Jesus said, and it'll happen. And I think that does happen. And it's amazing when it does. But then there's other times where miracles look a lot like showing up with a pickaxe and a bucket and moving a mountain piece by piece by piece with a lot of other people. And so for me, that's kind of how I've approached justice work ever since, is just saying, you know what, maybe I can't pick up a whole mountain and cast it into the sea of my own strength. That would absolutely be a work of God, and I pray for that. But in the meantime, I will show up with a little my bucket and my little pickaxe, and I will keep shouldering into it, and hopefully we'll see mountains begin to move.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, and I think sometimes we do slip into sort of magical thinking, like,
right.
You know, instead of thinking, well, hands and feet of Jesus, that's not like, you know, laying around. it would be doing something, you know, it would be acting.
Yeah. And again, a lot of times I think the temptation is to either, you know, think that you have to sell everything and move there and do it and like totally upend your life and your context and everything else. And you know, people that do that have my complete admiration, and I'm glad and thankful for them for sure. Or we think that because we can't do that, or we are unable to, that means we just have to shut down our pathos, that we have to shut down our heart, or that we have to become numb to it, or that means that we can't do anything. And I think there's a third way there in the middle of saying, you know what, maybe I still live in the suburbs, and maybe I still have four little kids and I drive a minivan, but I am still going to show up, and I'm still going to pray, and I'm still going to do what I can with my little bit here. And hopefully, you know, just see, you know, something amazing happen.
Yeah. So I won't keep you too much longer. I just probably will ask if you were to talk to the audience that listens to the show, a lot of people who tend to create things or, you know, they might be listening to the show to kind of get encouragement for creating and continuing to create. Do you have any like words of wisdom for encouragement? What has helped you keep creating and keep pushing on?
Oh, that is a good question. I feel like I need to almost hear from other people perhaps for that. But I think for me, one of the things that I have that helps me the most is learning not to save my work anymore. In terms of helping me discover my voice, in terms of sharpening how I write and what I write and always finding new things, I have found that for me, creating like a lot of art is kind of like that idea of manna in the Old Testament, that there's enough for that day. And then whatever you've tried to hang on to and save, it spoils, you know, the next day. And so I spent a lot of years hoarding my best work and hoarding my best stories, thinking that I would waste them if I put them in on a blog or if I wrote them for a magazine instead of saving them for like the great Canadian novel or something like that, right? And instead, it just meant that I wasn't writing and that I wasn't creating and I wasn't, you know, even interacting with and wrestling with my stories, because it wasn't until I began to write them and quote unquote waste them every day that I began to really even understand them. And the way that I write about them now is very different than I would have 10 years ago. And so for me, I think if I had to say the one thing that has mattered the most for me is that showing up every day and creating something every day and not being afraid to waste anything. First of all, I don't believe there is any waste in the kingdom of God. There's an amazing economy there that nothing is wasted, nothing is spoiled, that it will all do what it was meant to do. But then even beyond that, when you clear that out and you give that space, there's always room for more tomorrow to now rush in. And so for me, having that create and give and make space, create and give and make space, and it continues to fill. And then that, of course, makes your art better. It means you're practicing, right? A lot of times I feel like as artists, what we're doing primarily is a lot of practice. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's something really amazing.
And it reminds me of, you know, the correlation with the manna. And then later, like the feeding of the 5,000, where there's,
yes,
you don't think there's enough. In the end, there's 12 baskets extra.
So good, Lisa. Yes.
So much more than you were expecting to be left over that you can't even eat it all.
Oh my gosh, is that ever true? You know, and that's just it, is that you end up kind of like, again, that's just so the kingdom of God, isn't it? Because you plant your little seed, and then you end up with like this mighty oak of righteousness, right? Or you have this little bit of leaven in the loaf and you end up causing the whole loaf of bread to rise. And I mean, that's just it. You just have your small bit that you bring and then God does something amazing with it. Even if all that's amazing is what happens in your own spirit and in your own soul and in your own life, you know, noticing it, showing up, creating, changes us. It's a really, I think it really is a spiritual discipline in my life and an altar for meeting with God. And so, yeah, that was that's totally true. I love that.
Yeah, it's beautiful to keep it in the front of your mind too, that's kind of, that's how it works. It's not that scarcity thing that we can get sucked into thinking.
There is always abundance. There's always more than enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when it comes time for you to release your book, it would be fun to get together again and hash out some of the details and get people excited to read what you're up to next. But I'm just so grateful that you met with me today, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time, and I appreciate our conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Sarah. Subscribe to the podcast and stop by sparkmymuse.com and leave your comments.